Welcome back to another episode of You're Wrong with Molly Hemingway and David Harsanyi. You can always reach the show, radio@thefederalist.com. We appreciate the mail. In fact, this will be a mailbag edition, special edition of the You're Wrong podcast, Molly.
First off, do you not love the mail we get just in general? Isn't it so wonderful?
Well, yeah, you love it. Everyone's like, Molly's the greatest. So
that's not true. You get a lot praising you. But everyone's just so well spoken and they have interesting things to say. Yeah. And it's just nice. Like, I would do this if nobody listened because I just love talking to you. But I love that so many people also enjoy it.
Well, it's certainly nice to hear the feedback and know that people are listening and really listening to what we're saying. And sometimes they disagree and sometimes they add to my knowledge about issues. So I'm appreciative for sure. In fact, I've been thinking, and I think I might have mentioned this on air, that maybe we should do a Facebook Q&A with our listeners one time. I don't exactly know what that is or how it works, but I know it's like it exists out there. So maybe we'll think about that. I should mention a couple of things. So we get a lot of mail, mostly praising us. I think people are starting to learn about you as well, Molly. So you're getting some new fans. It's nice. But kidding. But we can't really answer that. We appreciate it, but there's nothing there to say, right? So we're going to skip that mail, but we do appreciate that mail. Another contingent has written to say they really want to hear us get into a debate on the economic populism that we had promised. So I think we'll save that for next year at some point. Do you agree? Yeah. That's too, you know, that's a big topic.
Yeah, we failed. We promised that we would do it like the next episode.
There was no due date on it. We can still do it.
It's going to be a year long fight probably.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote a column about some of that stuff and I it's a fight I want to be in. And I think it's important to have, not just with you, which I actually think you're quite probably more moderate than a lot of the new right types who are anti-free market. So, but I think it's an important debate. So, but I will start now with some of the mail and I'm going to ask you some questions and myself some questions that we'll discuss. Okay. So yes. We have one from Gary. I'm not going to give last names, right? Because I've not gotten permission from these people or anything like that. Right.
Right. I think you should. I think first names are fine.
First names are only. Okay. So this is from Gary. And it's a longer email, but he does ask of you an interesting question, given Molly's unquestionable journalistic integrity and her rightful criticism of other so-called journalists. I would find it very interesting to hear of an event or situation in her career when it was not easy to maintain that high degree of integrity. Was there such an incident that you can think of?
I just had one where I didn't feel great. I don't know if this is a good answer to it, but I will first off say that in the book written by the Prince of Darkness, Robert Novak, isn't that what it's called? Prince of Darkness.
Yeah.
It's kind of a biography of his journalistic career. And he told a story. The first time I read it, I was horrified by it. The story was that he was a young reporter in St. Louis, I think, and he went out to the bar after work, ends up kind of hitting it off with another person who's at the bar. They have a good chat. And as they're leaving for the night, they exchange names, at which point he realizes the guy that he got along with really well is the same person he had just kind of written an attack on. And he said the lesson he took from that is to never have friends. I'm paraphrasing. I'm probably doing a horrible job of it, but I was horrified. I thought, what a horrible lesson that this is what you would take from it. And for much of my journalism career, it just wasn't an issue to know some of the people I covered, or it just wasn't like that difficult to do my job honestly and have friendships. Most of my friends I have are like family, neighbors, and church. I'm not chummy with a lot of, I am chummy with politicians, but not in a way that compromises the friendship. But I did feel this week that I pulled some punches on someone who I greatly respect, who's Bill Barr, because I don't know if it's not a friendship thing necessarily. It's just, I was asked on, you know, like Mark Levin show to kind of go after him. And I declined and I got a lot of negative pushback on it. And I had to admit that if he were not, I don't know, if he were a different person, I might have gone after it differently. I don't know if that's an answer to the question or not.
That's quite interesting. I actually, you know, not that he asked me this question, he asked you, but I'm going to answer as well. When I was a Metro columnist in Denver, that was a report, you know, people, it wasn't just an opinion column, it was a reported column. And I often, you know, I actually broke, and it wasn't Watergate or anything, but I broke stories from time to time. And I learned quite early that a lot of people wanted to be friendly with me because I think they wanted to preemptively make sure that I wouldn't write negative things about them. So I basically avoided that. And most of my friendships and the few friendships I have are not, certainly not with any kind of politician. And there's a lot of that goes on in media. I don't know if people realize that. You know, people are, you know, it's just this circle of people who become very friendly with each other and do pull their punches all the time. You admitting that you did that, by the way, is something, because most people do it all the time and would never even worry about it or admit it. Right?
And I just feel like I didn't do a good job just now of explaining it too. I do understand the frustration with the former attorney general. I do personally wish he would have handled some things differently. I just also think he did a lot of great things under very difficult circumstances. And so, you know, I had a reason kind of, but I had to admit that I might've handled it differently with a different person. But, yeah. What you said, though, is absolutely right. People in D.C. in particular, it's all just like an incestuous situation where people are literally married to or sleeping with people that they're covering, and they don't reveal it. My husband and I are both journalists, so we have to occasionally, you know, kind of like concede conflicts. And I think that's what you should do, is just admit the conflict of interest and just be public about it, and then people can judge it.
Yeah. And I avoided friendships, not so much with people who I was critical of all the time, but actually people I mostly like, because you never know when you have to go after them, and it will happen. And people will often act like they don't care, but they definitely care. And it's very difficult to maintain any kind of friendship, and you just don't want it to interfere. And I'm not saying I'm like Joe Principal here or anything, but I will say that I've said this to you privately, that I am not a religious person, but everyone needs principles to live by. And one of mine early on was like, I am not going to pull punches, even with people I like, because this is what I do for a living. And if you don't have any kind of guiding, you know, set of ideals that you live by in your job, then really, you know, why are you here?
So I do also want to say that there's like this other side, if you don't mind me going off on this.
No, please. But, we have time to fill.
I teach journalism at Hillsdale, and I talk about ethical issues that you might encounter and how to handle dealing with sources who maybe don't have a lot of experience dealing with the media. And I know there are a lot of people out there who will interview someone, and they'll be interviewing someone, and they don't establish what the terms of the interview are. And then once the person realizes that this could go in a story, you know, you think, how could they not know this? But they realize it. Then they go, oh, this is off the record. And the reporter will be like, I never agreed to that. You're screwed. And I had a pretty explosive story a few years ago where I had a really hot tip. It was confirmed by key individuals in the story. They were older, and they just flat out, you know, I just called and asked them, and they both confirmed something. And then it was kind of aware, these are, again, older individuals who probably didn't think through the consequences of what they were doing. And I did nothing wrong. You know, I called and I asked and I got confirmation, but I still felt that they, if fully informed, would not have handled it the same way. And so I got the confirmation, but I protected their identity because it kind of came back to me freaking out. And I know a lot of reporters would think that that was the wrong thing to do, but I feel like it's important to treat others as you want to be treated. And sometimes that means.
I kind of disagree. Okay. On that front. I mean, I just, first of all, I think that journalistic ethics are self-evident, right? Like, they're pretty, not saying that you're teaching, you know, to me at least, it seems like, you know, when something's right or something's wrong. But I am definitely in the school of cutthroat journalism. Like, if you need to break into someone's house to get information that the public needs, I think that you should do it. If you, you know, if you can trick someone into telling you something on the record, you should do it now. Not civilians, not regular people who have, yeah, which it seems like that's the story was. Yeah. If you're hurting someone for something that wasn't really newsworthy in that way, or you can tell the story without destroying someone's life, that's one thing. But I am, especially politicians, I'm for doing whatever you need to do to get a story. And quite often that's not the case with many journalists who have favorites. And you know, this is why I, you know, again, not that I'm breaking, you know, Watergate or anything, but this is why I try not to befriend politicians who I just, you know, don't trust anyway because of their chosen career. It is to me immediately suspicious that they would want to have power over other people, things like that.
I also say, you know, there's an aspect of self-interest in this too. Like this, sometimes when you treat people well and you allow them to kind of have a take back, you know, on whether something's on the record or not, you get a better lifelong relationship with them where they know they can trust you. And that
Might
be helpful. I think like one of my best traits as a reporter is high profile people know beyond a shadow of a doubt that I am trustworthy and discreet. And it has given me a lot of good stories because people know I'll take the time to work with them and be careful about it. And so you can either get a really explosive story and then you blow up the relationship, or you can have like kind of a lifelong relationship.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. You want to build sources and you want to definitely be trusted by those sources and things like that. I would say I write a column. I'm not really breaking a lot of stories anymore, so this doesn't really come up with me, but I will give you one quick story, if I may, about in the year 2000, I was covering the subway series between the Mets and Yankees for Sports Illustrated, where I worked. I don't know if people know, as a sports writer, no conflict of interest there, because no athlete ever wanted to befriend me in any way. But it was the Yankees and Mets, and I'm a huge Yankees fan. So I was there for the, I think it was 5 games, I forget, but I was supposed to go down to the locker room and cover the Mets, you know, write the stories about the losing team because I was young and not that experienced. But I immediately went into the Yankees locker room against the rules and got to see them celebrate and basically like celebrated with them completely unprofessional behavior. It's like, yeah. And so that,
you know, I almost feel like if you're a sports writer and you don't have a rooting interest, it makes you a worse sports writer.
How are you even a fan of sports if you don't have, like, I mean, how do you love sports if you're not a fan of a team, right?
And I did a lot of religion reporting, and I'm a hardcore Lutheran. And so I think, again, just being open and honest about who you are is fine, and then you can cover it. But like, if you weren't, I think it's actually hard for people who have no interest in religion to cover religion. It's not impossible. I've certainly met good reporters who have no interest, but it's just
how about people who hate or know nothing about religion? Can they cover religion for the New York Times or any other larger paper?
Do you remember when the New York Times used to do job ads for religion reporting? They'd be like, you don't need to know anything about religion at all. And it's like, you wouldn't imagine a sports writer be like, you don't need to know anything about the sports world. It's in fact good to know a little about the sports world.
Yeah, I think so. So here's another email, just quickly, if people are listeners, they know that you had mentioned something about a Bach Canada that you heard with your kids somewhere. I believe it was
the chaperone for the Bach Cantata.
There were readers, one named Stephen, who was very disappointed that you did not give the name of the Lutheran hymn, and they wanted to know if you had, since that point, tracked it down.
It was BWV 121. So it's Christum Weir Solen Loben Schon. As my pronunciation might indicate, I am the family member who doesn't speak German. My husband, who's a convert to Lutheranism, does speak German, so I should have him say it because I don't know how to say it. So it translates as, we should praise Christ highly. So the hymn written by Martin Luther is based on a Latin poem or something like that, I think, but I can't remember.
Okay, that's enough. I think that's enough information.
It is beautiful, and I enjoyed it. And it's not one of the more famous ones. One of the things I like about all these Bach societies is they have this like desire to work through all of the Bach. And so you can get some stuff that you've never heard before, or that isn't quite as common. I don't think that's super popular.
I admire Bach, but I'm not like a big fan. A lot of it just sounds the same to me. Yeah, sorry.
To me, it's almost otherworldly, and I can't get enough. And so I have my whole record collection. I have all of my like rock, which is most of it, alphabetized A to Z. I have a jazz, like a huge chunk of jazz. I have a huge chunk of classical. I have a Christmas section, but then I have an extensive Bach collection. And there's not a bad one in the bunch. I mean, if it makes it to being a record, it means, you know, it was kind of worth it. But I just love...
I mean, aren't there things like culturally speaking, or maybe not even culturally speaking, that you admire, but you don't particularly love, that you understand is beautiful and that you understand is intricate and difficult to play and all that, and maybe even genius, but it's just not your bag. You know what I mean? Not your jam. Anyway, maybe not.
No, I think it's a good question, and I'm trying to think of it. There are things I appreciate that I don't, or this happens actually a lot with bands that other people just love beyond belief, or movies they love. Be like, well, I can see why they would like that, but it's not my cup of tea.
Right.
For me, Bach is like on a completely different level. I think he might not have been human. I mean, it's just, to me, tingles all the senses constantly.
I like dissonant sort of avant-garde classical music. I love the face you just made. Which I realize is not for everyone, and that's why I don't come out here and recommend, though. You know, I'm not like, oh, you should listen to Penderecki or whatever. You know, I don't do that, though people should give it a shot if they want. Here's an interesting letter. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but Veronica from Colorado makes a very interesting... Both you and I have ties to Colorado. You grew up there. I lived there for a pretty long time. She makes this great case. We were talking about Colorado, about how the state is very weird in that it's almost impossible to find a candidate that would be a consensus pick for all the factions of right wing within that state. Meaning, if you get someone who's too moderate, the social conservatives, very social conservative folks in Colorado Springs won't vote for them. There's a whole bunch of crazy libertarians in that state. And then there's sort of a Denver area moderate Republican wing, but you can literally not find a single candidate that's going to appeal to all those. Do you buy into that theory?
First off, I just want to say that I thought it was interesting. She said she lived in Highlands Ranch, which was in the county that I grew up in, Douglas County, or that I spent a lot of time in, I should say.
And it's relatively new, right? Didn't they build that in the 80s?
Well, that's what I thought was funny. She's like talking about the changes to Highlands Ranch from when she moved in to when she moved out. And when she moved in, there were all these kids. And then when she moved out, there were all these dual income, no kid families, which, by the way, I just met dual income, no kid couple that live in Highlands Ranch. On this note, I'm going on tangent upon tangent. I know this person because I kind of work with them at one of the other jobs, and she lives in Highlands Ranch, and I love her. But I met her in person for the first time, and I met the guy that she's living with. So this is the first time I meet them, and I told them that they shouldn't be living together. Literally, the first words out of my mouth are, you shouldn't be living together. You should get married.
Tell them they're married.
Have I reached old lady status like a little too soon? Like, I'm just saying, there's no filter. I just went right there.
She said there's a moral argument for it, but also that married people with children are the wealthiest people in America. Studies show that's what you have to do. You have to give them hard data.
I'll just say it. This was at a party, and it wasn't the only couple I said this to. I then had a conversation with another couple where I said the exact same thing. I was like, apparently this is a Christmas party where I've decided to tell people no shacking, no living in sin, do what's right, get married. Anyway,
honestly, I'm getting old too, because I don't understand why people live together and just don't get married. If they have they feel long-term commitment to each other, you can make it work.
Yeah. As you know, for me, it's religious, but it's also just every study shows that getting married before you live together is a better recipe for success. So it's just,
yeah, my biggest regret is not getting married sooner and not having more kids. I think that people who don't do that will regret it. And obviously that's a big problem in society today. People get married late, too late.
Okay, so I promise I'm coming back to Colorado politics,
no.
but recently, you know, we have this like modest house, but it's in the DC area. So we're very happy that we were able to buy. We have our children that we just love. They're so fun and delightful to spend time with. And the house is decorated for Christmas. And so there are like twinkly lights everywhere. And the kids get all the stuff from their grandmothers and they set up little villages. And it's just like really beautiful. And Mark and I were listening to one of our children play the piano, and she like composes her own music and makes her own arrangements. And we're just sitting there like, this life is awesome. You know, when we were single, thinking about getting married, like we never would have imagined it would have been this fun to just build our family. And I liked them when they were young. I love them now that they're older. But anyway, okay, back to
I have Colorado. To now say, so if anyone's listening to this in my family, I honestly, you know, I love hanging out with my kids. I think they're funny. Maybe we like them so much because they're like us and we think we're really great. Funny. You know what I mean? I'm not sure.
Like, one of the kids has a lot of my traits and another has a lot of my husband's traits. And there's something about seeing those in both cases. There's something weird and interesting about seeing it in another human. And it has even helped me understand my husband more to see it in a different person. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, so when I moved to Colorado, Highlands Ranch was a ranch. It was called Highlands Ranch because it was a ranch with like many thousands of heads of cattle. Head of cattle. So then it became this development. And now apparently our reader, our listener is describing changes of it over time. But I completely agree with her assessment. The reason why Republicans struggle in Colorado is there's no... It's very difficult to find a candidate who appeals to the fairly winger social con contingent, the very extreme libertarian contingent, and then that like strong independent streak that has always.
There's also the militaries there, a lot of military too. You know, they're
that part's easier.
They're probably more like social conservatives.
Well,
the
there's
part.
Also a lot of libertarians in the military, so I don't think that. Oh, yeah, in fact, true. That might be one of the better unifying things, but it is a weird collection of people, and it makes it very hard to have success.
Yeah, so that was just
I also
interesting.
Think Arizona seems like it has the same problem. Like, I love that libertarian craziness that they have and social con wingerness, but it's kind of at odds with, you know, a lot of the problems that Arizona had, in addition to not running a ballot harvesting operation like Democrats did, was that they had a bunch of like squishy Republicans who just decided not to vote with Republicans.
It's always been tough in Colorado. And I don't know, you know, there's this Western libertarian type who, you know, who lives in Colorado. I don't know about other states. That is always hard to get out to vote. We had a numerous emails, one from John and others, eagerly giving me advice on how to be a normal person. You know, we had that conversation about human interactions, and one of them made me laugh because they said that, you know, they get excellent interactions in their work environment. Well, I work from home in a room by myself, so I can't do that. Another person told me to go play pinball and join like clubs. So I'm actually maybe going to do that. I'll report back to you. Not pinball, because pinball is stupid, but like maybe darts.
Why is pinball? Is pinball like pin? I don't even.
Yeah. Know. Like the fifth, those. Yeah, you pull it back. It's kind of an arcade game. You don't know what pinballs are? Pinball machines?
I just haven't seen one in a long time.
Oh yeah, no, it's like the pizza place when I was a kid. I'd go there and they'd have like the one like Space Invaders or Defender, and then a pinball machine, which
Speaking
I never
of
understood.
Colorado, did you ever go down to Manitou Springs and go to their arcade, which
yes.
I love, and they have skee ball, which is my favorite thing to do ever.
Yeah,
I could
such
play
a
skee ball
kitschy
for
place.
Hours.
Manitou Springs, yeah. There was another place in Denver, which was, gosh, now I'm going to forget the name. But anyway, they had these old arcade places that were a lot of fun. I don't know, maybe everyone has them or not. Anyway, I'm not going to play pinball, but I may do darts or try to join a different kind of club, not dancing or anything like that.
What about Bowling. I really like bowling.
There is a bowling alley opening up near me. My problem with these, it was funny once with the kids years ago in Colorado. I'm like, I want to take you bowling. I used to bowl when I was a kid. And I walked into this place and it was just this old fashioned bowling alley where there, people were like still smoking inside and stuff and cursing and yelling. And they were like very small and horrified by what they saw. But the new bowling alleys are more like there was lights and music and things like that. But maybe I'll join a bowling club if they give me a shirt.
So there's a bowling alley near here, and I went once with the kids for like one of their birthday parties. And on the way in, like a sort of toothless man who appeared to be without a permanent address was talking to me. But I'm like with the kids, and I kind of try to not have a lot of interaction with people when I'm sure. with the kids. And Mark was there too, and he was like, honey, you know, like, did you hear what he said? And he like brings me back, and it was like a Fox News viewer who was like really happy to see me there.
So not a person without a permanent address, a person with a permanent address.
No idea. I'm just saying it was not.
It's funny because, you know, growing up in New York, quite often you'd be on the subway or something and someone would come up to you and it would take like a few minutes to figure out, is this person insane or is it a normal person? You know, and then they'll say something I'm like, oh, insane. This person's insane. Do you know what I mean?
Wait, also on the people just interacting, I was meeting with Emily Jashinsky at the office. That we have offices, and we went and got a coffee. And while we were there, and we were, you know, reviewing work and stuff like that. But while we were waiting in line for our coffee, this guy comes up to her and he was like, excuse me, are you Emily Jashinsky? Huge fan, was like so excited to see her. He was like visiting from Jacksonville. And I was like, did you set this up? Did you?
Now, I want to say something here. I am a huge Emily Jashinsky fan myself. And I did a podcast with her last week or 2 weeks ago. And she is one of the best interviewers, one of the best podcasters in the country. Would you agree with this? Obviously, you will.
I mean, I get this feedback all the time, and I agree. I'm not a huge podcast listener, but I love her interviews. But she'll frequently interview these very high profile people. The Federalist Radio Hour is known for its high quality guests and whatnot. And they will frequently text me afterward to say that they thought it was like the best interview they'd had on their book or the best interview they'd had about a very, you know, whatever the policy issue is, if they're a senator or house member or something. So
she has this breezy way about her, and but then she is really educated on whatever she's talking exactly. about, but it feels like just a very off the cuff conversation. Yeah. So we did a podcast the other week, and I thought we wouldn't have anything to talk about, and it was like an hour went by, like, and she was obviously knew exactly where she wanted to go with the conversation. So just I think people should listen to the Federalist Radio Hour. She is fantastic. Now we have a lot of letters where, so you and I debate basically this establishment base fight. I think people get my position a little wrong. I'm not pro establishment. I just don't think that the base.
You're
always
a regime lackey. Just kidding.
I just don't think that the base, the mass, the, you know, has it right all the time. I feel like they're quite emotional sometimes, and they don't deal with the world in reality. But someone sent a long letter. Joseph is the name of the person, where they go through the reasons why, you know, the base hates the establishment. And I think you want to talk about one part of this letter. I'd like to mention something. You know, one of the reasons given is that they have failed to overturn Obamacare, which is a very, you know, which for people forget now was the basically the number one issue and topic for a very long time in the 2010 onwards. So I think it's a little bit of an unfair critique because when you have a few moderates who stop a bill, it's not as if the establishment wouldn't have turned it over. Maybe in their hearts, they didn't want it. Maybe in their hearts, essentially, they didn't want, for instance, Roe to be overturned either. You can't bore into someone's soul. But really, it was just McCain one time who stopped the overturning of Obamacare.
No. I okay. First of all, I just want to say this letter was so great. I almost wish we could just publish it on the site from Joseph. But I totally get what he's saying. And let me just, you're zeroing in on the tree, and you're accurate about that. But I think there is this forest here that's very important. Like, think about the history here. In 2010, a beautiful movement springs forward, the Tea Party movement, 2009, 2010. It's a constitutional but populist movement that is devoted to getting rid of Obamacare. They bring forth this unbelievable overturning of the House. Like, how many seats did they win? It's crazy.
Yeah. And they won 1,000 seats nationally, basically. So,
and Republicans say, thank you, but we can't really do anything until you give us the Senate, right? So then in 2014, they deliver the Senate. Is that right? 2014? Yeah. And so then what do Republicans say? They were like, okay, we're almost there, but we actually can't do anything until you give us the presidency. And so against all odds, Republican voters like show up and they give the House, the Senate, and the presidency. And I will just say, after that happened, I was in a group of reporters who went to meet with Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. Nobody had expected Trump to win, obviously. Well, nobody in D.C. had expected him to win, but we were all there, and it wasn't like, you know, just a wide variety of reporters. And one of the questions was, what are you going to do differently with your agenda now that you have control of all three? And Ryan was like, I'm not going to do anything differently. There's literally nothing different I'm going to do. I'm going to still work on Social Security or something. And we all kind of looked at each other like, this can't be true. There was not the type of strategic thinking and plan about what to do when you make a promise to your voters and then they deliver, about how to make sure that you have everything like aligned to deliver on your promise. To say that the Senate didn't have that in line is even more. And yes, I understand Senator McCain thumbs down how much he enjoyed doing that, but it's not just his failure. It's a failure of the entire Republican Party establishment to convey the importance of giving to voters what they had spent so much time, money, and energy delivering, and making sure that they were rewarded not just with repeal of Obamacare, but with a replacement that made sense, with all the other policy goals they had in mind. And a strong establishment and leadership in the Senate can make sure you get the votes that you need. And so it was just a brutal attack on voters, and it was interpreted that way. And it kind of set the stage for just, as this writer Joseph notes, kind of like a legacy of failure over the next few years.
Well, listen, I wrote a column the day Obamacare was passed saying it was never going to be overturned, partially because Republicans are cowards, but also because there is just no entitlement program, or whatever you want to call it, that's ever going to be overturned once it's passed. It's just nearly impossible. But I just think that there were plenty of Republicans who did good work, and just simply saying establishment, basically hating the party in this way, is just counterproductive. But honestly, I'm not that concerned about it either way, because for me, gridlock's the best thing. And you know, you have a Republican Party that's a consensus party, and you're always going to have someone from Maine, someone from Arizona, someone from Pennsylvania who is going to be squishy on these issues. It's just very difficult for Republicans to pull together a party that's going to be walk lockstep on this sort of thing. So I don't know that that's ever going to happen. I just think the expectation is wrong. You know what I mean?
So I will say that I do think there's a truth to the fact that the Republican Party is a big tent party with a wide variety of views. I think that's true. And I think it's a bigger tent than most political parties have, and certainly than the Democrat Party. But you don't hear Democrats making excuses about the fact that they have like everyone from Ilhan Omar to Tim Ryan. They just all vote the same way, or they make sure.
They have an easier time. You know why? Because they are moving towards in a direction which is just, in my view, socialistic or, you know, statist. So for them, every growth is incremental, and they're happy with it because there's more to come. So Ilhan Omar has no reason not to vote for something that moves her in the right direction. Whereas Republicans who simply don't want to cut government. There are some who do. We're forget cut government, because it's such a, that want to cut, Obamacare or roll back Obamacare. But there are some that just simply don't, because they believe that's it's kind of policy they like. Mitt Romney believed that that was the right kind of policy, and he ran for president. So it's very difficult. I just think that for Democrats, it's always easier because they're just always growing government, and they immediately that becomes a new baseline wherever they are, and they move on from there. So it's easier for them. But so it's the same thing with Bernie Sanders saying, "Listen, I'm not going to vote for any iteration of this Biden spending bill that was passed through reconciliation." He wanted $5 trillion, but he'll take $2 trillion because he knows next time he'll get more. So it's just easier for him.
So I just want to get back to the letter though, because I really liked this letter. He also explains why there's such animosity between the base and the establishment. And he compares it to being betrayed by a lover. And I do think this is this reality that people are dealing with. They are upset. You know, obviously Mitch McConnell has been on record since really 2010 with how much he hates the Tea Party and how much he views his job is to crush this people's movement. And he's done it, you know, repeatedly. He's succeeded in crushing his voters. The voters share his hatred in the opposite direction because they feel just so frustrated that they have given so much to this party and they've gotten so little in return. And it is one of the clarifying things of the 2022 midterms. Obviously, Republicans took the House. It was generally good for them. They got 3 million more votes than Democrats, but they were really frustrated with what happened in the Senate and with not getting more in the House. And it's just worth remembering, like, Mitch McConnell kind of achieved his goal. His goal was to solidify his power, to keep the conservative populists out. He kind of succeeded in that almost. I mean, J.D. Vance got in and he tried to pretend like he was the reason for that, which is silly. But realizing that the biggest obstacle that Republican voters have to getting Republican Party policies enacted is the Republican Party establishment, it's a frustrating thing. It's also been good and clarifying to realize that so long as Mitch McConnell is the head of the party, working with Democrats on all of their major policy goals, weakly fighting in a few instances, or even doing a good job fighting in a few instances, but just not like really leading a political movement of the size and scope that the Republican Party should be having right now. It's clarifying and people kind of like understand they need to take out the corrupt leadership if they're going to have any success. And I feel like this reader got it.
One big lesson, though, that the reader should learn is that you shouldn't view your political party as your lover or your savior or anything of that nature. You should view it in terms of simply incremental goal setting and trying to get the best you can.
Did he not explain in detail in his letter about how they'd failed to do just that? Like that he seemed like a reasonable person who understood that you're not going to get everything at once. But he's saying when they haven't, you know, he gives the comparison of talking about like how much he worked to make sure Al Gore didn't win and he gave money and worked for George W. Bush. And then George W. Bush betrayed his own campaign promise against nation building to embark on two massive nation building wars in which this reader's friends were killed. Like that is a betrayal.
It's a complicated issue. I mean, I think the nation building was a huge mistake that we're still living with those consequences in many ways. However, what 72% of Americans favored going into Afghanistan. It's not like it was just some, you know, whim to do it. And I don't know, and I'm not bashing this reader, but he probably supported it as well.
Who? You think this guy did?
Did he support going into Afghanistan? There's a high likelihood he probably did at the time.
Also, you're the one who argues against being led by the people. A political leader should be leading. You know, if he says, I won't do nation building, precisely at the moment of passions, when like the deep state is saying, no, you have to build a nation here, is when a good politician will resist it. And I understand how difficult it is. We wrote about this. We interviewed President Trump at the height of some of the pushes for him to embark on or sustain nation building wars. He talked about how difficult it is, but that's a failure. That's like why you have someone be a leader, is so that they won't be vulnerable to that kind of pressure.
I agree. And in the end, you deserve either credit for bucking the people, or you deserve the blame for just going along with the emotions of the moment. I wrote a book about that. I'm completely understand. I'm with you on that. I'm just simply saying it's more of a topic by topic kind of, or issue by issue, moment by moment kind of debate, where I don't even know what we're arguing about anymore, frankly. I'm just saying that I think that it's a mixed bag. It's not that simple.
What did you think about his theory about why the establishment hates their voters so much?
What was his theory? That because they're just normal, law-abiding, patriotic Americans, and DC people hate them for that?
Well, yeah. I mean, he said, you know, we're not Beltway sophisticates in general. We're patriotic, more or less pro-life, law-abiding normals who play by the rules and actually love America. He says, I think deep down, we may even remind them of what they may have been like before they got in on the grift. So why wouldn't they hate us? I found that interesting because I think that it's worth exploring. I don't know if it's the answer, but I've actually kind of always been confused. Like, I don't even know why some of these people are Republican politicians, or why are they doing it? Like, how much more money does Mitch McConnell need? You know, like.
Oh, I think it's about power for these people, not money as much. But, you know, I think they enjoy, I mean, why are you in the Senate when you're in your 90s, right? Or in late 80s? It can only be your addiction to power.
So I don't get that. And then I also don't get why Mitch McConnell hates people like me so much.
I have an idea why he hates you. but
the thing that I thought was interesting about that line is that I will frequently get kind notes from people, or I will meet people who say something like, and they mean it like really sincerely, thank you for not changing. And it breaks my heart to hear it, because I'm like, you shouldn't be getting credit for it. Like, it almost makes me want to cry right now. Like, how many people have changed? You know, how many people have they supported in office who have then betrayed them once they got a voice? Or how many, you know, talking heads or reporters did they think sold out? It's just sad to me. Like, it shouldn't be notable.
Part of the problem is that these guys will promise anything just to get into office. So when they break their promises, they make promises they can't keep. That's a big problem. And that's the incentive to make those promises is very high, because incumbents, you get in and you're incumbent and you rarely lose. Mitch McConnell wins elections pretty easily, right? So I think that's part of it. I don't believe that people walk around hating you for being patriotic or being but maybe they dislike you for being unsophisticated. They think that you don't understand how things work. And I think people, you know, I'm not a fan of the people, even though I like persons. I think the people are often, as a crowd, you know, unsophisticated, but I don't think that's unique to the left or right. I just think that is. And I think a lot of these people, yeah, they do look down on their voters. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know why. I think also it has to do with them being in D.C. far, far too long. I don't know when Mitch McConnell got there, but it's probably the 80s, right? When he was a congressman. So,
I mean, technically think he arrived in the 70s and worked at the DOJ at that time.
Right. I mean, so you're no longer from Kentucky, right? You're from D.C. now, when you live in D.C. that long. And D.C. is a horrible place, as you well know. I mean, I don't mean that it's not a beautiful city. It's actually quite a nice city. I liked living there. It's a fun, nice city in many ways. It's not as, you know, I grew up in New York. I like DC a lot better, the pace of it. But the people there are not bad people, but
they are. It's okay, you can say it.
They're bad people. Their values are wrong. You know, they're not the same as other Americans. The way they interact is weird to me. It's always been weird. I was happy to leave there. And even though there are plenty of people I like, and, you know, those values, the values of Democrats and Republicans are quite the same when you become part of DC, you know, in the end. And that's why you get this omnibus bill that Mitch supported, right? They just, you know, they just don't think about the world the way a normal person does. And I don't know how to fix that, because in one way I'm very anti direct democracy, but in another way, it's very weird that you have a city so far removed from average Americans. you know, where you have these giant bureaucracies that have lifelong employees who just got a 5% raise, completely detached from the concerns of most Americans. Like, let's save the post office and make all the post office trucks electric. Like, who does any normal American care about that? I mean, this is what you're concerned with. But then I blame the people, because they vote in the same people, you know, the same candidates all the time. If you really hate Washington, you have, you know, everyone just hates other people's candidates and other people's representatives. They don't hate their own, probably. But anyway, I don't really have, again, I don't even know what we were talking about, but it's just a kind of a downer. I wanted to ask you a quick question. It's a letter from David H. Do you do New Year's resolutions?
No. I have some this year, though. I was just talking to my new executive assistant about some things I would like to do differently, which could kind of be viewed as a resolution. Like, I have had so many changes in what I'm doing with becoming editor at the Federalist that it has decreased my writing. And so I want to commit like one day a week to writing. My buddy Charles Krauthammer used to do that, where he would just like reserve one day for his column for the week, because he said if he didn't, it just wouldn't get done.
Yeah, I'm big on them, actually.
The Fox News. Like,
he was so great. Even though you probably didn't agree with him on a ton of stuff, he was a pretty strong neocon, right?
Oh, totally. I mean, not only did I disagree with him, I heckled him once at AEI when he gave the speech to about how we needed a new foreign policy of nation building. I heckled him, and my husband was so mortified. But what I loved about him is that he was fine with disagreement, unlike so many of... So it's just, it's very frustrating. Like, when you go on TV, your job is kind of to disagree with each other, but then some people take it really personally. And I feel like I disagree with everybody and I don't take it personally. I have like a long track record of not agreeing with most people in DC, and it doesn't affect what I think about them as people, you know? And he was always just a complete joy to debate with. Like, we would fight on set, and then we would go back to the green room and fight some more, and then we might carry it over the next day. But it was like fun, and we wanted to hear each other's side.
I only got to meet him once, and he was a real gentleman and very fun to be around. I think, you know, I noticed, and I spoke to Emily actually about this on her podcast, but you know, I am very interested in writing as a craft as well. Do you know what I mean? Not so much always opinion. And though I didn't agree with Krauthammer all the time, I think that I'm not sure that people understand how clear, straightforward, and beautiful his sentences and arguments were constructed in those columns. Like, if you're learning how to column write, you should just buy his books and read his columns.
Or even you should reread his speech about going to war in Iraq. It is, I so disagree with it, as I just said, but it's a beautifully written and argued piece, and you should reread it because it does not hold up well.
And I believe he began at the New Republic. I think, you know, a lot of the neocons were basically social engineers on a wide scale that were interested in that sort of thing, which obviously has never appealed to me at all. But I should say, we talked about, you know, journalistic ethics, that I did in columns support the Iraq war, which is my most regrettable position that I've taken. And a lot of people who attack me for it, or not a lot of people attack me, but those who do, including Molly Hemingway, have to understand, I think, that, and this is a bad excuse because I shouldn't have given in to this thing, but after 9/11, I think that a lot of our perspectives were skewed by what had happened in a personal way that doesn't usually happen in politics or even war, where I was living in New York when it happened. And I think that unfortunately skewed my, I should have tempered my emotions, I think, when I was writing about those subjects, or perhaps not even written about them very much at all, because I'm not a foreign policy person.
I want to ask about your New Year's resolutions, but I just have a quick thought on this too. At the time of 9/11, I was working for a libertarian group and in the DC area. And one of the weirdest things was experiencing this attack on our country, this horrific, awful, like, you know, attack in the city that I lived in. And some of the people I worked with, their immediate concern was that we might go to war in retaliation. And I was like, oh, wow, these people are crazy. I mean, if your natural reaction when at that point, you know, we thought it was like tens of thousands of people had been murdered, right, was not that you have to like make the people who did this pay, there's something wrong with you, right?
Yeah. I mean, again, I am not anti-war in the way that a lot of libertarians are. I was perfectly I was perfectly fine with punishing people, anyone who had anything to do with bombing them to oblivion. I'm against nation building, yes, basically. Exactly. So yeah. I would have had no problem, even with Hussein, who had more to do with 9/11. I'm not saying he had any kind of knowledge of the exact plot, but was a haven for all kinds of terrorists, deserved to be bombed and to be weakened. I just think that following through with the nation building part was problematic. Yeah, I want to stress that I'm not this, you know, libertarian anti-war type. I haven't changed my mind on that. I just think I fell for the democracy building part, which is a big problem. Though I have to, in my defense, say very quickly, mm-hmm, I made a U-turn, and I'll tell you what pushed that was that Israel, soon after, you know, I think it's 2002, 2003, gave Gaza over to the Palestinians and let them vote and have their own little democracy. And they immediately voted Hamas in and threw all PLO moderates off building demonstrations. And I'm like, wow, you know, that's a problem. I'm like, I've never really liked democracy. I don't know what the hell. Why would I want to build one elsewhere? It seems like a problem. Anyway.
Have I ever told you about the time I got kicked out of Ramallah?
I don't know. No. Did you ask some tough questions of the PLO? I vaguely remember this. I think we were already working together, right?
Yes, it was after we started. That's like a story for another time.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy to hear that. Ramallah is a dangerous place. I wouldn't want you to be in danger there. So I did quickly want to say, I'm not going to share my specific New Year's resolutions, but I'm actually a big, big fan of them. I think goal setting's important. And I usually make resolutions and I make them happen. But the key to that, giving unsolicited advice to listeners, is the making them achievable. Like, come up with something that's achievable. And it's not just about the ends always, it's about process. Like you say, I want to write more, you know, so you set aside every Wednesday, and no matter what's going on, you write that Wednesday. So I am a big fan of New Year's resolutions. So yeah.
Great.
Wanted to quickly mention that this person who wrote that wonderful letter also praised one of my television choices, Slow Horses, starring Gary Oldman. I've been watching season 2. It's fantastic. It's a British show. With Gary Oldman and a bunch of actors I don't know, but it's excellent. It's like kind of Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, that kind of thing, you know, Le Carre stuff. Yeah. And another reader who I want to give credit to, give me a second here, named John, J-O-N, who praised and tells us to watch the series Occupied, a Norwegian production. Without spoilers, it involves Norway, Russia, Europe, and a little bit of the U.S., and it's about energy. And
you remember when you tried to make me watch that? And
yes. Then,
like, my husband still won't watch any David Harsanyi recommendations.
Yes.
You made us.
This is that. Occupied was the show that kicked off. This is probably 2017 or 18 before I left for a bit and came back. Where I recommended Occupied, a Norwegian show about a Russian invasion, just very topical right now, of Norway, where they take over because Norway decides they're no longer going to produce oil, which would, of course, in the real world be excellent for Russia, who does produce oil and gas and would just now corner that market more. But anyway, it's a fantastic show. People should watch it. I think there's 2 or 3 seasons. And that's it for me. I was going to give some music recommendations, but I realized that the things I would recommend are so inaccessible that I would probably just insult readers with them. So
go ahead.
Sure? Okay. Well, the most accessible one is a new Dinosaur Jr. album called Sweep It Into Space. I think it might be 2021, but it is actually a return to form, in my opinion, really well done. You have this, I don't know, people who know about this sort of thing, that Sebado, you know, singer is the bassist in the band. He has some songs. It's really good. There's a band called Off, O-F-F, which is like a punk band. And they have an album called Free LSD, which is like, imagine mixing punk and prog rock together and making an album. It is amazing. I think people will enjoy it. I'm not sure if I want to really give any of these. And Horse Lords has an album called 0 Degree, I think it's called, and it's fantastic, kind of a jazz kind of thing. And a band I think you might like, though not every song, but I think you will like them in general. They're kind of like, have a dance beat, but they're guitar driven, kind of like post-punk, kind of maybe in a way, like Public Image Limited, something like that, but maybe even more dancey. They're called Party Dozen, and the album that I heard that was pretty good was called The Real Work. So I would make those recommendations for my end of year favorites.
I'm intrigued. Okay.
Yeah, I will send you that last one. I'll send you a song. Okay, I think if you start with the first song, you might not like it. It's good. Just feedback.
I'll give it a shot. It sounds intriguing.
And I just wanted to mention, I will do a better job of collecting these emails. It's a little messy, but I'm going to do a better job of answering emails. And so will you, Molly. We'll do these shows occasionally if people like them. You can mail us at radio@thefederalist.com. Hope everyone has a nice new year. And be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.